All right, so thanks for giving me this opportunity to speak, and also to all of you to come on despite like a short notice. So today I'm going to tell you about the wrinkling of bacterial biofilms and the branching in developing lungs. But before I do that, I'll just say something about my background. So you know, I'm trained as a theoretical physicist. I'm originally from Slovenia, and I did my undergrad at MIT with Mehran Kardar and Arup Chakraborty when I was working on statistical physics of immune system. After that, I did postdoc with David Nelson when we were studying how thermal fluctuations affect mechanics of thin sheets and shells on a small scale, where thermal fluctuations turn out to be important. But while I was there, I started working with engineers, in particular with Katia Bertoldi, on so-called mechanical metamaterials, where the geometrical structure can lead to interesting properties, mechanical properties that you cannot find in natural systems. For example, you know, like here, like you just have like a simple structure where you just punch holes, and when you compress it, it's gonna collapse and form like these like nice patterns, right? And another thing you notice that as it collapses, it effectively, you compress in one direction, but it also collapses in the other direction, so it has effectively a negative Poisson's ratio, which is quite unusual for the natural materials. And you know, like this is just one of the examples, but there are many, many examples where you can play with geometry to tune mechanical properties. And now, in the last few years since I joined Princeton, you know, like I still work on these two things, but I start like many new topics, and I'm coming back towards you know, like more biophysics areas. So inspired by intracellular liquid-liquid-like phase separation. Together with Miko Hataya, we were studying phase separation in multi-component systems in order to generalize the ideas that we are usually know from binary and ternary mixtures. Together with Daniel Cohen, we are studying expansion of epithelial tissues either on patterned substrates or unpatterned substrates. With Sattar Taheri-Aragi, who's actually here in California, we were studying how bacteria deal with antimicrobial peptides. And here, I'm going to show you a movie. What you will see that the peptides were fluorescent attacks. So initially, they're all everywhere in the background. And then what you will see that as this movie goes, bacteria will divide, but some of them will turn green, which means that they're absorbing a lot of antimicrobial peptides, which are trying to kill them. And as a result, basically, once they get killed, you know, they absorb, like, you know, basically, their cell wall gets damaged. Basically, their interior gets exposed, and through electrostatic interaction, they suck up a lot of dangerous peptides from the environment, and they effectively help the rest of the bacteria survive, right? So, for example, here, you're seeing this is dividing, but now the ones that turn green, they stop, they're dead, right? So basically, you know, like through this passive system, they help the rest of the bacteria survive. And, you know, like if you actually want to kill this population of bacteria, you actually have to inject like a lot more antimicrobial peptides than you would naively expect. And then like the mostly related to morphogenesis, you know, like in the last couple of years, you know, we also started working with STAS on certain aspects of egg chamber development in Drosophila. And with Bonnie Bassler, Howard Stone, and Ed Wingreen, we started looking at the development of bacterial biofilms. And with Celeste Nelson, we started looking at the lung development. So today I'm going to focus on these two projects. And you know, I'm here for the rest of this week and next week. So if you're interested in any of these other projects, if you want to chat more about these two, you know, feel free to talk to me. OK, so we're going to focus on wrinkling and branching. And that's actually quite common in development. So you know, we all know that our brains are wrinkled, but maybe you didn't know that actually we get these wrinkles even before we are born, right? So halfway through the pregnancy. So these are actually like MRI images from human from fetus, and this is like the fetus 20 weeks old, and this would be like just like before we are born. And you see that initially the surface is smooth, but then it progressively gets wrinkled. And basically what is believed that at this stage, neurons migrate towards the cortex. The cortex effectively swells and becomes too large for a given volume. So as a consequence, the surface will wrinkle. So Amy gave a talk yesterday, and you know, like she mentioned that in the past, she has studied like this villi formation inside the gut. And this is in chick embryos, so you know, this is the age of embryo of 6 days, 12 days, 15 days, and so on. And if you look at what's happened inside this gut, initially, so these are the sections across the gut, and these are sections along the gut. And what you see, that initially the interior is smooth, but then you start seeing some stripes and these zigzags. And basically, if you look at the cross section, you see that actually it's going in and out. So these really are wrinkles. And basically they're related to the formation of smooth muscles. And basically, it is believed that these smooth muscles basically effectively constrict and compress this gut tube. And initially, at the first stage, you form like circular smooth muscles. So you only have compression in one direction, which will give you these stripes. And then at the second stage, you develop longitudinal muscles. So now you have biaxial compression, which will lead to zigzags, as I will show you later. And then at the final stage, you know, like once you have this template, then you have pattern growth on top of it in order to really get these villi out of the zigzag pattern. And then, you know, like we also have like a lot of organs that are branched. For example, you know, kidneys are branched and lungs, and there are some other ones. And in kidneys, it's actually like a patterned growth that leads to these branches. But I'll show you that in the lungs, it is not the patterned growth, but it's rather patterned formation of these smooth muscles, just like in guts, that will be important for these branching. Right, so the outline of my talk is, first I'm going to tell you a little bit about background about this wrinkling instability, because not everybody may be familiar with it. And then I'm going to tell you how this plays a role in during the development of bacterial biofilms grown on soft substrates. And then I'm also going to comment how this wrinkling instability is suppressed in developing lungs. Okay. And, you know, feel free to stop me at any time if something is unclear. Okay, so the basic mechanism that leads to wrinkling instability is that you have some stiff skin on some soft substrate. And substrate can be either liquid or solid, viscoelastic, it doesn't matter. And, you know, if you compress the system, then if it's compressed only a little bit, then the surface will still be smooth. But once you compress it beyond some critical threshold, then the surface will wrinkle in order to try to release this compressive stress. And, you know, initially you have like nice sinusoidal wrinkles both on a liquid substrate and on an elastic substrate. And then if you compress it further, then all these wrinkles will merge into one giant fold when you have liquid substrates. But on an elastic substrate, if you compress it further and further, then you get like period doubling where you have like deeper folds every second wave and like shallower folds every second wave and so on. Then if you go further, you can even get period quadrupling and so on. But at least at the early stages, you always get like nice smooth sinusoidal. And you know, you can test with your skin, you know, if you compress it, you see that you get like very ordered periodic wrinkles. Okay, and why do we get wrinkles and not buckles? Like, you know, like if I take like just like a stiff skin and if I compress it, you know, like you would get buckle like this, right? And you know, like the bending energy of the skin would like to be minimized by having as large buckle as possible. But you know, when you do that, you also have to consider the deformation of the substrate. You know, here maybe you have like gravitational energy when the fluid has to move up or down, and here you have elastic deformation energy of the substrate. And it is this competition between the bending of the skin and the deformation of the substrate which leads to this preferred selected wavelength. Yes.
Is there a specific definition of buckle and wrinkle here? Is the green curve, couldn't that just be a wrinkle if I zoomed out? Or is there a definition that you're...
Both of them, like I could call buckling everything. I could also call this buckling.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
So here I was just like referring to the classical Euler buckling that people may have been familiar with, right? Where you know, you get like some structure like this.
Thank you.
But you know, both are mechanical instabilities. Yes.
I was just curious, based on a talk from yesterday, if you like compress and stretch, do you get like periodic wrinkles or like compressing and stretching the same structures as we saw in the triple blacks?
Yeah. So what do you mean by you mean part is compressed, part is stretched. Okay. So very good. So what's going to happen that in the region that's stretched, you're going to have tension and it's going to be flat. And in the region that's going to be compressed, you're going to locally form wrinkles, right? And now, whether you're going to really see wrinkles or maybe like huge buckles like these depends on the region, how big is the region that you're compressing compared to the wavelength. Because we'll see the wavelength is set by the material properties and the thickness of the skin, and not by anything else. Yes?
But I would have thought that you would have said that the difference is that in what you're calling buckling, the wavelength is set by the size of your system.
Very
good. What you're calling wrinkling, the wavelength is set by material parameters.
Very good, yes. So here, the wavelength will be as large as possible, which is set by the system size, right? And here, the wavelength is finite, and it depends on the material properties. Okay. And you know, like here, what we're going to have in mind is like imagine that again, like I said, like we have a skin, and like we're going to have a substrate, and the substrate will be much, much thicker than the skin. And now let's say that they're both growing, and first, you know, like imagine that they're detached, right? So the red skin would grow by some factor, the strain, effective strain GF. And the substrate would grow by a factor GS. And the interesting case is when the red skin grows more than the substrate, right? And now if I force them to stay together, if I stitch them together, now initially they start with the same size, but now after they grow, if they're forced to stay together, then, you know, like they have, you know, something has to deform, right? And one option is that the substrate will stretch, and the other option is that the sheet will compress. Of course, if the substrate is very, very thick, you know, like you're going to have to pay a lot to stretch it. So the substrate will basically deform very little, so the skin will have to compress. And if the growth mismatch is very small, smaller than some threshold, then indeed, like they will, the surface will stay smooth. But if the growth mismatch is larger than some critical threshold, which depends on the ratio between the Young's modulus of the substrate and Young's modulus of the skin, of the film, then you can actually minimize the energy of the system by not compressing the sheet, but rather by bending it. And on top of that, you know, you also have to deform this substrate, right? And again, the wavelength is proportional to the thickness of the film and to the ratio of the Young's modulus of the film and the substrate. Right? And this is a asymptotic expression which holds in the limit where the film is much, much stiffer than the substrate. And then if they are comparable, then you have corrections to that. Right? But roughly the idea is that this wavelength is roughly constant and independent of how, so you know, if the skin keeps growing, what's going to happen to the wavelength will remain roughly constant, but the amplitude of these wrinkles will grow. And we roll roughly as a square root of the difference between this growth strain minus the critical strain, right? So it's the usual, so for physicists, it's like similar to the second order phase transitions, right? Okay, so this was like now effectively 1D problem when we're compressing from one direction. You know, like you can also ask yourself, what happens if you compress it in two directions? And for example, people can do experiments, they can just swell these gels. For example, now they have like stiff skin and like some soft substrate, and now they're gonna maybe like just comment here. What would happen if the substrate would grow more than the skin? So if the substrate would grow more than the skin, then the skin would be under tension and the surface would still be flat. There would be no instability, right? Maybe the skin could fracture, but there would not be wrinkling instability like here. Okay, so but now if you have biaxial compression, so this would happen, for example, when red skin swells more than the substrate. So now again, beyond this critical strain, which actually scales in the same way as for the 1D compression, maybe there's like a different numerical prefactor, but the scaling is the same. So if the strain, if the swelling strain is smaller than this critical strain, then the surface is smooth. But then you start seeing these wrinkling patterns. It's interesting that here they got like hexagonal bumps, which actually were not expected, because theoretically you would expect these herringbones on flat surfaces. And they speculated that maybe these came from the curvature, as I'll show on the next slide. And then the idea is that now, you know, like if you compress, if you have like a uniaxial compression, then you would get like these like straight of wrinkles, because in the third dimension they would just be straight, so it would be just like these undulations. But now once you compare these undulations from the other side, then you get like these zigzag stripes. And the spacing here between these bumps or these zigzags scales in the same way as these wavelength of wrinkles that I showed you on the previous slide for the 1D problem. Right? Maybe there's like a numerical prefactor difference, but the scaling is the same. This wave characteristic wavelength only depends on the thickness of the skin and the ratio of the stiffnesses of the two materials, right? In the development, you know, like we may also ask, what is the role of the curvature? What would happen if the substrate is curved, or is the if the whole system is curved, right? So there were also experiments done on spherical shells where you have like again thin skin on spherical substrate. So these already shown deformed. So initially it's like really spherical like that. And here, this was not swelling, this was actually mechanical compression, but the idea is the same, that you know now they have like a cavity inside through which they will suck out the air or inject some air so that they will have effectively a pressure difference. So when they suck out the air, they create like a pressure difference, and now when they suck out the air, then you go from smooth to dimpled surface. And now when they inject air, it's going to become smooth again. And you know, so now you see these are dimples like a crystal, and you know they could vary the pattern by changing the ratio between the radius of the sphere and the thickness of the skin. And if this ratio was small, then they got dimples, and when this ratio was increased, they got these wrinkles. And then there's also interesting intermediate phase where you can have coexistence of dimples and wrinkles, right? But, and again, the scaling is exactly the same. Right, so the characteristic wavelength very weakly depends on the radius of the sphere. Right, so it's really dependent by the thickness of the skin and the ratio of the material properties. Yes, is there a question?
Well, yeah, maybe the size of the domain sphere is purely set by the geometry, purely proportional to the radius. I mean, in the bistable and wrinkled phase,
yeah,
you have domains which are.
Oh, I see. What sets these domains? Here it depends on the kinetics, on the details of kinetics and microscopic imperfections of how exactly you're compressing this. Are you compressing it fast or slow? There will always be some imperfections in the system which could, like, you know, set trigger different domains. Yeah. So it's definitely this is not a annealed system. It's quenched.
It's a silly question, but
yeah.
The hexagonal phase one, that looks like a golf ball.
Yes,
is that
exactly.
How they make golf ball dimples?
No, they don't make them like that. But actually, exactly the idea of the golf balls was actually motivation for this paper, because what they wanted to do in that paper, they wanted to have a way of, like, you know, dynamically tune this roughness of the surface. So you know, when it's dimpled, the drag resistance is lower, and then when it's smooth, the drag resistance is higher. Right. So that's why the golf balls have dimples, so that you can effectively reduce the drag resistance. Okay, so this is like a brief intro into wrinkling instabilities. I didn't want to go, you know, there has been a long history, like, you know, like I mentioned. So here I put like one of the, so these like already discussed in one of the textbooks from in the 60s, right? So this is like a very old problem that has been studied extensively in engineering, and still to these days people are still exploring these wrinkle structures. Okay. So now I'm going to tell you like what happens in developing bacterial biofilms. And as I said, this was done together with Bonnie Bassler and Howard Stone and Ned Wingreen. So here we're going to grow biofilms of Vibrio cholerae bacteria on the agar substrates. So we're going to start with a liquid drop containing bacteria. The liquid quickly evaporates and will be irrelevant here. So you know, we have like, so now this is like a top view of this with the microscope. And now bacteria will start growing. You know, they get nutrients from the agar and they start growing and expanding. So you see these expanding rings. And now you see that wrinkles are forming here. Right? So this is just a microscopic, so it's not really clear that these are wrinkles, but if you look at the actual topography, these really are the wrinkles that are coming up and down. Right, and a few notes. So this film, this is like a very, so it's like a pancake. It's a very thin film. It's like roughly 100 microns thick, which is like many bacteria. Each bacteria is like roughly 1 micron in size. And what sets this thickness is basically these bacteria, when they want to grow, they need nutrients from the agar, but they also need oxygen from the top, right? And these biofilms are very impermeable for oxygen, so basically the 100 microns is roughly like the oxygen penetration depth, right? So it's and this basically sets the thickness of the skin. And another thing that you see is that the spacing here is quite uniform. And you know, as we said, that you know the wavelength of wrinkles only depends on the thickness and material properties, right? So if the material properties are homogeneous, and if the thickness is roughly uniform, then we should expect a constant wavelength, right? So I'll play this again, so you can see how it develops. So you have like this disordered core that's related to initial drop, and now you see these radial wrinkles shooting up. And then you see that the edges, you have like radial wrinkles, and inside you have like these disordered, these like zigzag patterns that I mentioned, like these herringbone structures when you have biaxial compression, where here it feels like you have like more uniaxial compression just in that direction. And I'm going to comment on that later. Yeah.
So here the high profile is the one of the biofilm. You have also the formation of the agar.
Okay, so we have done cuts. And then like image from sideways where we see that the agar also deforms. So that's also a good comment. So initially, so as the biofilm deforms, the agar deforms with it, so they stick together. At the later stages, the biofilm actually delaminates. So you know there's a finite adhesion between them, and then you actually have like channels underneath where you know have water and everything, right? So I'm only going to focus on the first stage, where you really have wrinkling, and I'm not going to talk about delamination in the second part. That happens at the later stages. If I would keep playing this on, you would see like very sharp, dark stripes which correspond to these channels. Okay, and you know, so basically, as the bacteria, so you know, it was not a priori clear that these are really mechanical wrinkles. You know, these could be some other patterns, right? You know, as these bacteria are forming biofilms, they're growing, dividing, they produce extracellular matrix, they produce lots of other proteins. So, you know, it could be some other mechanism that leads to these wrinkles, right? But now I'm going to try to convince you that these are really coming from mechanical instability. And so where is the compression coming? So, you know, like I said, they stick to the substrate. So when they want to expand, there's some friction which will like cause compression. Right. Okay, so how we went about checking that? So first we wanted to test if the wavelength is uniform across the thickness. So what we did is, you know, we just put like a circle around this a circle of different radii on this biofilm, and we just counted the number of wrinkles along the perimeter. And you see that the number of wrinkles grows linearly with the radius of the circle. And because the perimeter grows linearly with the radius, this suggests that the spacing is constant. And indeed, you see that, you know, because you have to, accommodate more and more wrinkles as the biofilm grows, you know, you have these bifurcations where these wrinkles split into multiple ones. And the wavelength is pretty constant. Right, you can also change geometry. So rather than starting with a circular drop, we can start with the razor blade. So now we have like this straight configuration. Now the biofilm still starts expanding, and again you see these wrinkles forming. And if you would like, if you measure the wavelength of wrinkles in this configuration and in that configuration when they're grown on the same aggregate concentration, you find that the wavelength is the same. So the wavelength does not depend on the geometry of the biofilm, right? But we can actually go further, you know, like from mechanics, we know what the wavelength should be if we know material properties, right? So what we did, we have grown these biofilms on agars made from different concentration, which changes the stiffness of the agar. It could also affect, you know, the properties of the biofilm. So we also measure the rheology of the biofilm. And we also measured the thickness of the biofilm, which was like pretty constant. Here, like the stiffness changes a lot, but the biofilm properties don't change that much. And here, you know, like once we measure the shear modulus of the agar and the biofilms, you know, we could calculate what is the predicted wavelength. And then we compare this with the measured wavelength from experiments, and we see that we get very good agreement. There's some deviation here in this corner, but you know, this is not too surprising because, you know, this formula is, like I said, is an asymptotic formula which holds when the stiffness of the film is much, much larger than the stiffness of the agar. But, you know, like, these kind of really suggest that these wavelengths are coming from, that these patterns are coming from mechanical instabilities. So now we wanted to go a bit further and also, like, explore these patterns in more details, right? So why do we get, like, radial stripes here? Why do we have these zigzag patterns? And of course, there's also this, like I said, there will also be this disordered core, which comes from the initial inoculation, right? So we're going to ignore that part. We're going to focus on what's happening here, right? And again, if you play this movie and if you analyze what happens, where are these sectors as you increase time? So initially, at the early stages, you know, you have this disordered core. But the rest of the biofilm is smooth, right? So initially, you don't see wrinkles. Initially, it's smooth edge. And then eventually, the wrinkles show up. And then, you know, like, so you have, like, radial wrinkles that show up, and then they expand outwards. And then you see, like, these zigzags patterns starting to form inside. So this actually is not the chymograph. So this is, like, this is the chymograph, you know, like, that, you know, where these, you have time. And here is, like, a pattern depicted as a distance from the center from the biofilm. This actually is not the chymograph that corresponds to this movie because you see the agar concentrations are different, but if I would plot this one, it would look very, very similar. Another interesting thing is that, you know, here the radial wrinkles started somewhere inside and they propagate outwards. But if you look at these chymographs of these developing patterns, and you compare them, what happens when you grow them on soft agar versus stiff agar, you see that on a stiff agar, the radial patterns begin inside and propagate outwards, whereas here, the radial wrinkle patterns would, like, start first on the outer edge and they will propagate inwards. It's a bit hard to see these in movies, but you know, like, when you analyze them carefully, like, you see these. So we're also going to try to comment on that. Like now through the mechanics model. So how now we're going to try to understand this via model. We will try to include the diffusion of nutrients through the agar. Some of the nutrients will get uptaken by bacteria, and this will lead to growth. And then because of the growth, the film would like to expand and so on. Right. So we have, like, diffusion of nutrients here. This is the uptake. For simplicity, we're going to ignore the third dimension. We're going to assume that that everything is in plane. So this would be corresponding to the limit when the thickness of the substrate is very small. You know, like, this leads to some minor quantitative differences, but qualitative effects are not changed. And you know, like, I can tell you later if you're interested in these details, right? So this is the diffusion of nutrients. This is related to the uptake of bacteria. And the bacteria, so epsilon G will be the growth strain, local growth strain. So, you know, like, the bacteria which evolves as bacteria grow, and the growth is nutrient limited. So that's the usual Michaelis-Menten-like function. And in the bacterial community, this is also called Monod's growth law, right? You know, like, because when the concentration of nutrients is small, then the growth depends linearly, but then you have saturation. There's some maximum growth that you can achieve, even if you have, like, infinite amount of nutrients. And once this will lead to growth, you know, like, then the biofilm would like to grow and expand, but there will be some friction between the expanding biofilm and the substrate, right? So you know, like, again, you have, like, divergence of stresses will be related to this friction force. And the film will be modeled as a thin plate, right? So we're not going to model the whole 3D film, but we're just going to use the film mechanics of thin films. And then once the stresses inside the film will reach a critical threshold, then this wrinkling instability will occur. Right? Before I mentioned that the wrinkling happens when you have critical growth strain mismatch, but you know, of course, the strain is related to stress, right? We have material properties. Okay, so what happens when we analyze this model? So initially, you have like nutrients everywhere in the agar, but then as the bacteria start growing, they uptake the nutrients, and you start seeing. So this is the radius. So this is like the profile of nutrients underneath the biofilm, where the R is equal to zero is the center of the biofilm, and we're going outwards. And you see that the bacteria quickly start depleting the nutrients underneath them. So as a result, initially they grow quickly in the center, but then eventually they will start starving. And then most of the growth is actually restricted to this nutrient-rich zone, which spans like roughly about a micron from the edge of the bacteria. And that's actually also consistent with what we see in experiments. If you actually look at where the bacteria are starving and dying and where they're happy and growing, you know, you would see that you have like this like growth zone at the edge. You see like and then here the edge correspond to the actual radius of the biofilm at different times. And what you see that the profiles actually go through different stages. So initially, when the growth is small, when the bacterial film just begins to form and grow, so there's basically no, so these are velocity profile of these biofilms. So how each point is fast is moving radially. And you see that there is like basically no movement in the core except that the only place where it's allowed where it can move is at the edge, and that's because initially the stresses are the friction is suppressing this motion, except at the edge where like you know there is like a stress-free boundary condition, and at the end you can expect. And then gradually the stresses will build up and will be large enough to beat the friction. And then intermediate stage, you have like this like uniform expanding profile. And here the dotted lines are the simulations, and the solid lines with these error bars are coming from experiments PIV reconstruction of the experimental data. So it's just the PIV analysis. And you see that we do see these different regimes also in experiments. And then at the later stages, once the nutrient get depleted, then this will like reduce the growth in the core of the biofilm, and then the only expansion happens at the edge. And then at that stage, you kind of reach like a steady state where the edge expands with roughly constant velocity. Yeah?
The buildup of stress is the elastic energy stored from the growth?
Yes. So basically, you have like the growth, right? So if you don't let it expand, then effectively the film is under compression because it would like to be larger, but it's compressed. So you have compressive stress. And this compressive stress can get partially released by expanding, so by fighting this friction, right? And then the stresses gradually build up. And you know, initially you get like this. So here you see like the radial stress, and here the circumferential or hoop stress as a distance from the center of the biofilm. And you see that initially, and you can also measure the stress anisotropy, so you look at the difference between the two stresses. So if the stress anisotropy is zero, then the stresses are isotropic, they're the same in all directions. And if the difference is like one, then the circumferential stress is larger, and if it be minus one, then the radial stresses will be larger. The stresses are quite uniform, so you have like roughly constant stress everywhere except near the edges. So here it's uniform, except the anisotropy is large at the edges. Now, then at the later stages, you get like these parabolic profiles. And again, like at the very edge, the radial stress has to go to zero just because there's no force at the edge, while the tangential stress is allowed to be non-zero. And that's why it's very anisotropic there. And the later stages, because of the depletion of the nutrients, the growth slows down in the center. And as a result, the stresses will not build up as much there, but you know, now as a result, the peak of these stresses can shift outwards, right? And it's and you know what, it's also going to be important where this maximum, because you know once the stresses reach a critical threshold, that's when the instability, wrinkling instability, will happen. Yeah.
And you don't allow for variations in thickness.
We allow for that, right? So basically, the film is made of like nearly incompressible material, right? So when it's compressed, the thickness will increase, right? So we allow for that. Okay, and so now what, you know, like now we're also interested in, so as I said, like what will be important will be the profile of this stress anisotropy, but also will be important where the maxima of these stresses, because that's where the wrinkling will first happen, right? And as I said, the stress, so the stresses are quite uniform inside the center, that's why we'll get the zigzag. Once the wrinkling stability happens, and they're quite anisotropic at the edges, where the circumferential stress is larger than the radial stress. So as a result, we have like more uniaxial stress, which would lead to these stripe patterns. And here are characteristic chymographs that we would get in simulations. So you know, again, over time, and here is like, so here, like this is the expansion of the biofilm. So you see that like it expands roughly uniformly at the later stages. So initially there is no pattern, so like the surface is smooth. And then once the stresses reach a critical threshold, then at the location of the maximum, you're going to get the first wrinkling patterns. And interestingly, you know, like consistent with what we saw in experiments, I'm going to show you again, we saw that when you have like low argon concentrations, so like so small stiffness of the substrate and like low friction, then here you see what happens as we vary friction. You see that the maximum of the stresses shifts towards larger values. So at large friction, the maximum is in the center. At low friction, the maximum actually shifts towards the edge. So you know that's why on low other concentration, you know, we expect the patterns to merge near the other edge and then propagate inwards. Whereas on the stiff agar concentration, you have like more, the peak is in the center, so the wrinkles will emerge from the center and then expand outwards. And because of the stress anisotropy, you know, the stress is very anisotropic near the edges, so you have like so you know the circumferential stress is much larger than the radial stress, so you're going to have like these like radial stripes. Whereas in the center, you have like more isotropic stresses, so you're going to get like these zigzag patterns, right? So, and here is again comparison with what we see in experiments and what we see in our model, right? So you know, like I already showed you that like you know the wavelengths are consistent with the predicted wavelengths are consistent with what we see in experiments based on this mechanics model, and it seems that this mechanical model can also explain some of the patterns that we see in experiments. Okay. Are there any questions related to bacterial biofilms before I switch to the lungs project?
So you said that there were bifurcation points.
Yes.
Where they were opening. How do they get set? So I understand there must be a few, but
yeah.
The specific location is dictated by what?
I would imagine that the specific location, they want to be, there's some energetic reason why they want to be spaced as far as possible. Where exactly they happen could, you know, be related to like small microscopic imperfections on the substrate or something, I don't know.
But when you do a model, do you see the same thing, or you do see?
Yeah, we do see them showing up, yeah.
So and in the model, then where do they appear?
We have not really analyzed this carefully, but I can imagine that you know, like you have to do this on some grid,
yes.
Right? So when you discretize the system, you also have like some, you know, like numerical artifacts. I mean, like imperfections or something like that, which would dictate where this happens. Yeah. Okay. So now let's switch gears, and now let's talk about developing lungs. Right, so and we're going to look at the developing lungs in mouse embryos. So these are microscopic images of lungs at different stages of development. So these are like 11 days old embryo, 12, 13, 14, 15. So you see that you start with a very simple wishbone structure, and in a few days, you know, you start like you form like this very elaborate tree-like structure. And you know, you form new branches either via bifurcations or via these so-called domain branching. So here, bifurcation is just split the ends of the branch into create two daughter branches, and you have domain branching. Off of the existing branch, you create like a lot of these little side branches. And the formation of these branches is very stereotypical, so it's highly reproducible. So it always happens at the same location, and like the order of these branches is very reproducible. So you know, you can also look at the images, and you know, somebody can tell you how old the embryo was. And you know, they can also extract these lungs from the embryo, and they can keep them alive, and they can still like grow and bifurcate and create like more branches. Right, so you know, they can keep them alive for like a couple of days, but then eventually they do die. Right? And now once they have the system, they can actually try to manipulate with it and try to see how these branches form. So what's actually, like just let's first look at the structure of the lung. So what's giving the shape of these branches is basically a single layer of epithelium. So a single cell layer of epithelium. Inside the epithelium is like a luminal fluid, which is slightly pressurized. And then outside the epithelium, you have like another soft tissue, which is called mesenchyme. And it's believed that this mesenchyme dictates and tells this epithelium where it should grow and branch and so on. And you know, it can do this with, you know, growth factors and other signals. And another way they can manipulate this is that part of the mesenchyme cells will differentiate, and they will form these red stripes, these like stiff, smooth muscles that you see here wrapped around. And what I will try to convince you that these stiff, smooth muscles are important players. It's not that you have like a patterned growth that will decide these branches. You might also ask, you know, is there like any apical constriction after all this epithelium, right? And it turns out that in the birds, there is apical constriction where these branches are forming. But in mammals, it is thought that there is no apical constriction, or at least it doesn't seem to be important, right? And you can see that, you know, these branches, they're quite rounded. They're not as sharp as, for example, as during the gastrulation of Drosophila embryo that we saw. Okay, so how we figured that these smooth muscles are important. So a few years ago, they already did one study when they studied bifurcations of these branches. And what they saw that under normal conditions, the new smooth muscles will start forming at the tip of the branch. They will completely wrap around these branches, and they split these into two daughter branches. But now, if they use some chemical factors to try to prevent this differentiation, what they would see is rather than having two daughter branches, they'll get like a lot of wrinkles that I discussed before. Because you have like growing epithelium surrounded by soft tissue. And you know, once the epithelium grows too much, there's mechanical instability with these wrinkles. Right? And so now where I joined is like when we start studying like the formation of these domain branches, so there will be like a new side branch that will like show up here. So again, they extract these from the embryo that was 11 and a half days old. They grow it, and now they see that there's like a new branch showing up here. Right? So we want to now understand what leads to the formation of this new side branch. Again, they look at where are the smooth muscles. So initially, when they extracted the embryo, there were already some smooth muscles. They were like on this left side, and they were wrapped around above the location where the new daughter branch was forming. And then over time, they saw that the smooth muscles again completely wrapped around these daughter branches, and they would, but they would leave a gap where this new branch would form. So under normal conditions, you would get one new daughter branch. But again, if they use, you know, certain chemicals to try to mess up with this differentiation of smooth muscles, they would see additional branches, or sometimes even branches on the wrong side, you wouldn't get under normal conditions. Yes?
In the gap, you know, that you have smooth muscle with a gap, right? How do you anchor the smooth muscle so that you don't get, you know, extension to the opposite end of where you would have the gap as well?
So you're saying, like, why is there smooth muscles here but not here?
Right, and yeah. Why is sort of the physics, you know, going in one direction as opposed to going symmetrically around the
camp? Okay, so first, the growth is not exactly isotropic everywhere. You will see, I'll show you on the next slide that there is more growth on this side than on that side. That already breaks some symmetry, right? And then exactly what causes this pattern of smooth muscles, we still don't entirely know. You know, there could be indeed some morphogens that set this pattern, but there could also be some mechanochemical coupling, right? Yes?
At the gap, you draw these red muscle cells, which which seem not to be mechanically connected to something.
So they really are attached to the epithelium.
Okay.
Right? So this is the first layer of cells surrounding the epithelium. So they are mechanically attached to the epithelium.
Okay. Is it a continuous attachment, or do you know whether it's the end of the muscle cell which is attached?
I don't know. So
okay.
So this is the image where you can see how they wrap around. But
you don't have the what sort of adhesion molecules are involved?
I would not know. Like, I would have to ask my collaborators. Yeah. But I believe that they really are attached. Another thing is that, you know, smooth muscles can also contract, like, you know, can cause them to contract via calcium and so on. And you know, like, so they think that they're also, like, contracting a little bit as these branching are forming, which would help squeeze the epithelium through, right? Okay, so now let's look at the growth patterns, right? So now what they do is, like, they use some marker which, like, labels all the cells that were dividing at some instant of time. So here the colored and the gray pictures are the same. So, you know, like, here in the red is just colored epithelium, and the green is the and the rest is the mesenchyme around it. And, like, everywhere you see, like, a white dot here is the cell that was dividing at some instant of time. So you can get a sense of where cells are growing, right? And of course, you see, like, a lot of growth where the new branch is forming, and you see, like, a lot of growth also above and below and also in the surrounding regions. There's, like, less growth on the other side, right, which breaks that symmetry that we mentioned before. And now, if you look at these cross sections at the branch and above and below, again, you see that there's more growth here and on the right side, both here, both above at the branch and below, and there's, like, less growth on the other side. You can actually quantify this. You know, like, we broke this into, like, different angular sectors at these cross sections, and we just counted the number of cells that are growing, that are dividing in at that time in each sector. So we get, like, probability distribution of the number of dividing cells, and we see that they are biased towards the right side at all stages. So this is at the time, at the early time where the branch beginning to form, and then at the later stages, you know, once the smooth muscles really, like, start forming around these edges, you see that this isotropy gets away. So, you know, here, and you know, the growth is more uniform here, and inside the branch is still anisotropic. And in fact, so this just shows you the relative growth on the right versus to the left. So you actually quantify how much growth there is. You would see that the growth is initially quite isotropic. There's, like, roughly the same density of cells that are growing in all over this stage initially. But then at later stages, once the smooth muscles become here, then the density of the growing cells is going down here and here, but whereas here it's still remaining roughly constant and it's proliferating. Right, but what you see that at least at the early stages, there doesn't seem to be, like, a localized growth to these tips of the branches where the growth will happen. So we kind of have, like, roughly uniform growth here, right? So this already suggests that, you know, like, it's not that pattern growth that causes this branching. Okay, so now we would like to understand, like, what is the relative role of this growth versus the smooth muscles. So I'm going to show, like, a little bit of modeling to try to convince you that it's, like, that it's mechanical constraints that are provided by these stiff smooth muscles that kind of localize these wrinkles, I mean these branches, into these gaps between smooth muscles, right? So I'm going to use, like, the model of growth you know, I'm just going to kind of give you like an overview. I'm not going to go into details, right? So the basic idea is that you have like some object, and you have some reference coordinate system in the undeformed state. And then after it grows and elastically deforms, you're going to have a different shape, which is going to, and you're going to have a mapping from the internal coordinate system to the lab coordinate system that's described by some map. And this total deformation can be decomposed in one part that's coming from the growth. So this will be the fictitious stress-free state. And then another part that's coming from the elastic deformation. In the language of mechanics, when you allow for large deformation, we use these deformation gradients, which are basically derivatives of these maps. And these total deformation gradients can be decomposed into in this multiplicative decomposition, where one part is coming from the growth, and another part is coming from the elastic deformation. So in the linear elasticity, this just means that the total strain is the sum of the growing strain plus the elastic strain, right? And then it's only this elastic part that leads to stresses. And for those of you who are familiar with Eran Charon's work and other works, is that if the growth profile is incompatible, then you need to have some stresses and elastic deformation in order to, you know, maintain integrity of the whole system, right? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to prescribe this growth profile. I'm just going to use the profiles that we see in experiment. I'm going to try to minimize the total elastic energy to see like how the system relaxes, right? So so this elastic part of the deformation tensor is going to cause elastic energy. So here we just use Neo-Hookian system, Neo-Hookian elastic rheology. But it doesn't. The detail, I mean, qualitative effects would be are irrelevant of the kind of the model I use. So here, what we have like two elastic constants, mu and lambda, two Lamé constants that will describe material. And then, because we have different materials in space, so these elastic constants will depend on the position of the space, depending on where different material is, right? So you know, like here, like we're gonna simulate like a 3D tubes. So this is like a side view, and this will be like a, so this is like a cut through the tube. So it's really like we're simulating the full tubes, and the color here tells you like the stiffness of the material. So inside is the pink is the epithelium, which is slightly stiffer than the surrounding mesenchyme, and then the smooth muscles are the stiffest. And you know this is like so this choice was consistent with what is believed in the community for the elastic materials of these properties. And they're all quite soft. They're like, you know, I forgot to mention that, you know, the Young's modulus is on the order of kilopascals, right? And then what we're going to do, I'm going to prescribe these growths. You know, so, you know, you can describe like a radial growth, but there is no radial growth because, so I'm going to, I mentioned there was growth both in the mesenchyme and epithelium. And for simplicity, I'm only going to simulate the growth of epithelium, because it's only the relative growth that's important, right? So now we're going to only grow the epithelium, and the rest will not grow. And then, you know, like I said, you know, you can have radial growth, circumferential growth, axial growth. So there should be no radial growth because you have like a single layer of epithelium, and you know the size of epithelial cell is defined. So there is no radial growth, and then. In principle, we have both axial growth in the z direction and the circumferential growth. And for simplicity, and you know, we tried both, but I'm going to show you movies now. Well, I only consider growth in the z direction, and not much is different between the two cases, right? So first, I'm going to show you a movie. Well, we're going to prevent any new differentiation of smooth muscles. I'm going to say that there are some smooth muscles that were there from the beginning, but no new smooth muscles will be forming. Right, so that the color map will like stay constant over time, right? And then I'm going to prescribe this growth. So there is no true dynamics on this system because you know this growth is slow; it happens over the course of a day, right? So I'm going to assume that we're always in quasi-mechanical equilibrium. I'm going to prescribe some growth. I'm going to minimize energy, prescribe some more growth, minimize energy, right? So the movie that you'll see is like when you gradually increase growth. And consistent with what we see in experiments, there will be more growth on that side than on the other side, right? So now this is beginning to grow. You see that it's beginning to bend a little bit, And it's bending because this side is growing more. So that's just like the usual bimetallic strip idea. So, you know, one side's growing more, it bends. But now, as you see, you know, like, but once it grows, you know, the epithelium is growing faster than the mesenchyme. So the epithelium would like to expand, but, you know, the mesenchyme is preventing it. So the epithelium is under compression, and once the compression becomes large enough, you get these wrinkles. Yes.
So initially, the only differences in the growth is only where the smooth muscles are asymmetrically located, right? That's where you
okay. So we use some pattern of smooth muscles that's consistent with what they see in experiments. I didn't really show you, like I can show you the real data later, but you know this is a sketch of how the initial smooth muscle. So I was trying to mimic that with the initial configuration of smooth muscles.
You have like sort of a slanted kind of.
Yeah.
And then, but so the rest of the sort of the bottom of it without the muscle can grow as like equally.
Yes.
Almost.
Yes. So here the pink layer is growing. It's also growing here. In simulation, also it's growing here. But here it's surrounded by a stiff material, which is preventing it from stretching. Yeah.
If I understood correctly, the way you model this, that there is no slip.
There is no slip. Everything is perfectly attached.
Yes. Okay, so that's just one bulk with variable properties.
Right. Of course, and everything is perfectly elastic, which is also an oversimplification. We know that tissues are viscoelastic and so on, and we're working on that right now. And you know, we think that it's because of this wrinkling instability that you know that's why they see these ectopic branches in experiments when they block out smooth muscle formation, right? But now, what I'm going to consistent with what they see in experiments, then over time, we're going to try to differentiate these smooth muscles. So what I'm going to do in the model, at over time, as I increase the growth, I'm also going to increase the stiffness of some of this material. Right? So over time, this will like turn red, and the smooth muscles will form. But we're going to leave like a little gap, similar to what is seen in experiments. Right? So now, as this is growing, these are also turning red, so the smooth muscles are forming. And now, this formation of smooth muscles is enough to completely suppress wrinkling here. And the only way this growing epithelium can escape is through this little gap. Right? So we think that these smooth muscles are really like mechanically constraining these growing epithelium and are dictating where the branching can happen.
Is the inside of the epithelium empty, or do you have...
No, so there is a fluid, so it's a luminar fluid.
Is it exerting something?
So it's like slightly pressurized, so like I think the overpressure is like on the order of like 100 pascals, and the Young's model is like kilopascal. So it's slightly pressurized, but it doesn't, it's not enough to affect this wrinkling formation. So in simulations, we do have this overpressure. Okay, so, you know, like what we're doing right now, we're also analyzing, well, you know, we can also analyze the growth pattern of the mesenchyme. Like I showed you that we have like these data, there were spots of cells that were dividing in the mesenchyme. We'd also like to, you know, treat the mesenchyme as a viscoelastic solid in order to see like how these would affect these wrinkling and branching. You know, like I didn't really show you what would happen if this would keep growing. If I would keep growing the system, this branch wouldn't really get very far because the mesenchyme here is like deforming and elastically pushing back, right? And in order to relax this stress in the mesenchyme, if it's viscoelastic, it could relax stresses and allow the branch to propagate through. So we're trying to model this. And we also want to see like what would be the role, you know, like if the smooth muscles are not just forming, but they're also like actively constricting. Because like if you look at this movie, what you may see is that, you know, initially this is quite wide branch, but then at the later stages it actually becomes narrower here. So they think that maybe there's also some smooth muscles. So now it's narrower than initially, right? So you even see it here, it's narrower here than here. So there could be some constriction from smooth muscles that could also play a role. And of course, you know, if the smooth muscles are important, then it's also an interesting question, then what sets the pattern of smooth muscles in the first place, right? You know, is it like some morphogen that sets them, and then, you know, everything then just follows? But we think that because the branch already begins to kind of fold and then smooth muscles come around, There could also be some mechanochemical coupling, because the cells near the tip of the branch are really highly distorted. So if they can sense that they're stretched, you know, maybe they can just leave some signal which could suppress formation of smooth muscles there. So there could be some positive feedback that would cause that. Right? So kind of to summarize, you know, I hope I convinced you that these interesting wrinkling patterns that form in bacterial biofilms are caused by mechanical instabilities. And I should mention that, you know, I showed you this for the Vibrio cholera biofilms, but this is actually quite generic. It happens for many, many different biofilms when you grow them on soft substrates. And then in the second part, I try to convince you that, you know, these smooth muscles are the ones that pattern the formation of these daughter branches in developing glands. So, of course, I should acknowledge my collaborators. Like I mentioned, the biofilm work was done together with Bonnie Bassler, Howard Stone, and Ed Wingreen. Jing did most of the experiments, was a postdoc in their group, who's now beginning, starting independent career at Yale. Chen Yifei was a grad student working with Bonnie and Ned, who did some experiments and helped with modeling. Sheng is my postdoc, who helped like modeling in both projects. And the Lang project was done together with Celeste Nelson's lab. Katie Goodwin is a student who did all these experiments on these lungs. And Tristan was a visiting student from France who helped developing initial models for the lung simulations that were then continued by my postdoc. So thank you for your attention. I'm happy to answer more questions. Yes?
With the biofilms, my understanding was you wanted to ask if these wrinkles formed because of the mechanical properties or because of an active biological process. Is there actually literature or evidence suggesting that bacteria actively create these shapes in biofilms?
Even though it's mechanics, it's still active, right? Because, you know, the bacteria is still growing, right? But like what there was some discussion, like I said, eventually they delaminate. Mm-hmm. And what they found that underneath the delaminated biofilm, they often see like dead bacteria, right? So there were some speculations that maybe there's like some bacteria that are dying. Uh-huh. And then like it was like this pattern of dead bacteria that will like set where these biofilms will delaminate.
Yeah. Certainly, I know there's, you know, cell gene expression heterogeneity and morphological heterogeneity among the cells of the biofilm. So I guess this is part of the idea that they might also be sort of
Exactly. So, you know,
creating shapes.
Right. So there could be some, you know, reaction diffusion system that could cause these patterns.
Yeah.
But I was trying to show that it's really coming from mechanics and not by some other mechanism.
Yeah. And related question, are there other, different bacterial biofilms, slightly different? Any bacteria that you know about that whose properties might not satisfy your model?
Well, I can show you slightly, you know, like here's like a collection of these bacteria, right? Like many of them show either these disordered patterns inside, like their radial patterns outside. This one is interesting. You see concentric rings, right? And it is believed, what is thought that this mutant only, so it only forms extracellular matrix once it begins to starve. So you only have extracellular matrix in the inside, not on the outside. And we think that as a consequence, as this is growing, you'd have like larger radial stress than circumferential stress, which would cause disorientation.
Yeah, I was thinking of some Pseudomonas mutants that I've worked with that make wrinkles, but extremely different types of wrinkles depending on the mutation.
Yeah. And, you know, like here, the mechanics usually can explain the onset of wrinkle instability when the amplitude of wrinkles is still small. Once they're highly distorted, then you know, like the at least theory can't really say much. Then really, like you have like so large deformation that, you know, you can check them on a computer, but it's hard to say much analytically. No?
Does the wrinkles have functions? Like, so you said that in the center that they deplete away the nutrition.
Yeah.
So by having wrinkles, and then you said that sometimes there's a cavity beneath.
Yeah, yeah.
So then there's water, right?
Probably. Right. So there could be transport, right?
Yeah. And this pattern, well, it looks like it's a good pattern to bring something from outside, but is it kind of a sort of optimized pattern for that as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure if anybody has studied this aspect, but you know, maybe we'll hear more from Karen, like on Friday, like how these channels are formed and like what they're useful for. I don't know.
Yes. What's the transverse aspect of the radial wrinkles? It seems it's not sinusoidal. It's much more.
Initially, it's quite sinusoidal. I don't have it here. Like I would like we have it in the paper that we are writing right now. So it's very close to sinusoidal initially.
Okay.
But you know, like you're right that like once it really like highly deforms, then it's not perfect sinusoidal.
So is it really ridges up?
So basically, once it highly deforms, like what you see that you kind of have like, you know, two layers that are stuck together and just like, you know, go like this. Right, so initially like, it's like smooth and then like they will just come together and then just go. And then like once these ridges form, then you also see that you kind of start getting like these flower petals around, because like here the growth will slow down, but here it will still be faster. Okay, thank you.